Good afternoon and welcome to Open Air, KLW's weekly radio magazine of the performing arts. I'm your host, David LaTulipe. Today I'll be talking with actor Scott Wentworth, who stars as Goldberg in the stunning ACT production of The Birthday Party, a so-called comedy of menace by Harold Pinter at ACT. Composers Paul Drescher and Ned Rothenberg will talk about their upcoming premiere of Rothenberg's improvised concerto Beyond Sea, along with the Paul Drescher Electroacoustic Band and the Living Earth Show, concerts tomorrow and Saturday at Z-Space in San Francisco. I'll also talk with American-French violinist Lulu Delarue from the Budapest-based folk music ensemble Taraf Da Akatsa, which is currently on its second U.S. tour. Peter Robinson will also join in conversation with Scott Wentworth and will review a couple of movies for us and talk about the upcoming Mostly British Film Festival. All ahead this hour. Stay with us. This Friday and Saturday, the Paul Drescher Electroacoustic Band premieres Ned Rothenberg's improvised concerto Beyond Sea, a Drescher commission inspired by Terry Riley's sonically groundbreaking In Sea. It will feature Ned as improvising woodwind soloist. Also for this evening concert entitled Beyond, the Living Earth Show will premiere selections from Denis Amann's 24 Preludes and Fugues for Invented Instruments. The endlessly creative Paul Drescher Electroacoustic Band combines traditional acoustic instruments with the latest electronic sounds and technology. Some six versatile instrumentalists make up the group, plus a sound engineer, and the band performs an amazing repertory of American music that really defies traditional aesthetic boundaries and styles, if you've ever heard them. They've commissioned some 100 chamber pieces from American composers working in an array of different styles and idioms, including John Adams, Lisa Bielawa, Mark Applebaum, Fred Frith, Amy X. Newberg, Terry Riley, and Pamela Z, among many others. Always a pleasure to welcome Paul Drescher back to Open Air. Hey, Paul.
Great to be here, David.
Joining him is composer and multi-instrumentalist Ned Rothenberg, who has been internationally acclaimed for both his solo and ensemble music presented for the past 33 years on some five continents. His unique solo work utilizes an expanded palette of sonic language, a perfect fit for collaborating with Paul and company, which he did so together for a CD back in the 90s. Ned, welcome to you.
Thanks for having me.
Of course. Well, Paul, thanks again for being here. You're are just an endless fountain of creativity. It's such a pleasure to have you talk about your work and your collaboration. So this is a reunion of sorts with Ned, isn't it?
Ned and I have been colleagues since the early to mid-80s, and we've collaborated on, performed one another's work in a variety of different contexts in that time. We live on different ends of the U.S. continent, so he's in New York and I'm on the West Coast, so we're not together as frequently as we'd probably wish if we happened to live on the same side of the U.S. But we started out with it was Margie Jenkins commissioned a piece from me, and Ned, I met Ned first on a cassette. I was the music curator for a presenting venue in San Francisco.
I need to explain what a cassette is to our audience.
They're coming back, I understand.
They're coming back, yeah. I was the music curator at New Length and Arts, a multidisciplinary presenter of contemporary art in San Francisco. We accepted proposals from artists, and Ned was amongst a stack of many proposals that I picked up one day at New Length and Arts. And I put it on, and I was completely blown away. I just adored his approach to sound and his approach to his instrument and time and timbre and tuning and phrasing. Pretty much everything that went into music, I found something fascinating in Ned's playing and approach to the instrument. So then just a few months later, we ended up being on a double bill at New Music America in Washington, D.C. in 1983. And I think we both appreciated each other's solo performance. We each did solo shows. And so when Margie commissioned a piece from me, I just called up Ned or wrote to him. I don't remember what. We didn't have email back then. And said, hey, would you, why don't you just come out here to my house for a week. We'll just jam in my studio and with my technologies, and we'll record it, and maybe I'll get the material for this dance piece out of our jamming. And so Ned came out, and we jammed for a week, and it was incredibly rich in creativity and range. And because I was working with a tape loop system, then I could sort of preserve the loops that we had. And we knew at the end of that week that we had
actual tape loops.
Actual tape loops, yeah, physical piece of spliced piece of tape. And we knew that we had a lot more to do together. And so I went and made that dance score from the results of what just the recording, the two-track recordings that we'd made from those jam sessions. And then, but then we mapped out and executed over about the next 5 years, I think, the CD that we ended up being called Opposites Attract.
Nice. That about sums it up, Hanan, in terms of your collaboration with Paul.
When I first met him at the Air and Space Museum, he was performing his solo work with this tape loop system. So I was intrigued. I mean, without getting into the technical description of it, let's just say in our quote-unquote advance in technology, there are many things. It's always two steps ahead, and then but something's lost on the side. And there were many things that were possible with this analog tape loop system that actually would not be so easy on a GarageBand-equipped computer. Everybody has this idea that, you know, we're in this unending move forward technologically, but there's a richness in just as people are going back to LPs.
Cassettes.
Yeah, cassettes. there was a richness to his work that I think, and a richness to that particular technology that I think we really capitalized on in this record.
Mm-hmm. So you both really started off as instrumentalists. Ned, multi-instruments that you're involved with. We talked about your flute playing and your sax playing primarily. But when did it become evident to you that you wanted to do some composing and creative activity along the composing end of things rather than performing?
Well, I studied composition at Oberlin. I was always, composing and improvising, I guess I'm loosely considered to be somebody coming out of the jazz tradition, but there is this, I find, strange bifurcation that people have between composition and improvisation, like they are somehow foes that the people who make it up are a certain kind of free spirits, and the people who compose are the people sitting at the desk cashing it out.
Which is ironic, given early Baroque music that reviled
all the great
so
composers were
improvisers.
Yeah. If you read George Sand talking about Chopin in the Salon, his last written piece was amazing, but you should have heard him improvising at the party last night. And I think, if Chopin was alive today, he might be Keith Jarrett, whatever. But apart from that, so I've never found improvising and composition to be, to me, they're just various means to an end. And there are certain kinds of things that I know can be achieved through actually writing something down and making sure it's played at a certain time. And then there's other kinds of very important musical statements that I think can only be done improvisationally. So this piece that I wrote, it departs from, it takes the Terry Riley idea of using modules that are repeated and played in open fashion. They can be, in the case of Terry Riley's piece, the players play them as long as they want, and then they go on to the next. And Terry's piece is very democratic. But because the players are making the decisions, the piece is never the same twice. This piece also has a modular construction, except that maybe in undemocratic fashion, I've given the control to the conductor, in this case, Joel Duvall, Paul's longtime partner in his ensemble. He's a percussionist and a conductor. So the band is playing written materials, but Joel is controlling articulation, volume, when people come in and out, how much space they're putting in the materials. And I am just improvising over the top of it. and the in this case with saxophone, and the because the, and the it comes out of the inspiration that, I loved when I listened to NC or even when I listened to Steve Reich. I love that kind of music, but as an improvising musician, I've always felt like, geez, I'd love to play over the top of that.
Hmm.
I think it would be a little disrespectful to just, if it's like, okay, if you want to do that, then you better write your own piece. And so in this case, that's what I've done.
NC, a big inspiration for you, I imagine, as well, Paul.
Kind absolutely. Of fabric. Yeah, it was one of the pieces that really drew me into the contemporary music world. I used to play for Spare Change on my invented instruments back in 1968. And on Telegraph Avenue, and one day at the end of playing in front of Cody's bookstore, there was another hippie like me selling his record collection next to where I was playing. And I said, I saw this album that I'd never seen before, NC. And I said, "What's this?" He said, "It's awful." And he sold it to me for 25 cents. And this was back when records cost $2, though, and vinyl cost $2. And it changed my life. I just, you know, I'd never heard anything like it before. It somehow seemed the most natural thing and the newest thing at the same time. So that really set me on the path of trying to work with Terry Riley, meet Terry Riley, and I'll eventually study with him. And then we actually had the honor of commissioning Terry back in 2001. We commissioned a piano concerto from Terry to play with the electroacoustic band. And Terry said, "Well, I really can't write a piano concerto, but I wrote a banana Humberto." So we have a piece from Terry, a four or five movement, very large piece that Terry was a soloist in called Banana Humberto 2000.
And was his part totally through composed, or did he improvise?
He had a cadenza that he sometimes changed, but ultimately he seemed to write it out and play it the same. And he said he had to practice the cadenza more than any other part of the piece.
Well, let's hear a little bit of that Terry Riley inspirational NC, and then more with Ned Rothenberg and Paul Drescher. A little flavor of NC. Here I am being improper and talking over it as instead of playing over it. But yeah, it's something that is both hypnotizing and groundbreaking at the same time. Now, let's hear an excerpt from the 90s CD you guys did together. We do have a track called Opposites Attack. Tell me about that track.
This is a duo. Just I'm playing electric guitar, Ned's playing alto saxophone, and this is the one of the few tracks that was actually we could actually play this one live. A lot of what's on the CD Opposites Attract is built on the samples and elaborations from the original tape loop tracks that we made collectively in the studio. We wanted to do something that was not looped at all, that was just us playing live. And so this is an excerpt of that.
From Opposites Attack, the collaborative spirit of Ned Rothenberg and Paul Drescher, joining me in studio to talk about Beyond, their concert with the Living Earth Show tomorrow and Saturday at Z Space on Florida Street. Great stuff. So this concert not only involves your own collaborations, but the Living Earth Show. Tell us about that ensemble, Paul.
So this program has two halves, and Beyoncé, the premiere of Beyoncé, Ned's piece, is the second half of the program with an expanded version of the electroacoustic band. We actually have an all-star band of 11 players with some wonderful players who are both fine chamber musicians and improvisers, people like Ben Goldberg, John McGowan, Crystal Pascucci, Elaine Creston, Andy Meyerson, Jordan Glenn, one of my favorite drummers in the Bay Area, Emily Packard, Alyssa Rose, Lisa Mezzacapa, I think, have I covered it?
Elaine Creston,
yeah, I mentioned cello. So we have a great band there. The first half of the program is sort of realizing my desire to sort of promote the next generation of artists who are not like me but work in the same idiom of trying to push the boundaries and experiment in their own ways. And so it's another collaboration between this wonderful duo, the Living Earth Show, which is electric guitarist Travis Andrews and percussionist Andy Meyerson, and the composer, instrument inventor Dennis Amon. And Dennis has built a whole stage set worth of contraptions, sound sculptures, instruments, hard to know what to call them. They're very whimsical, they're theatrical, and Andy, the percussionist, is all over the stage playing many different manifestations of objects that make sound. There's a quadcopter drone, there's a giant, they call it a Sputnik, which is actually a form of a theremin. There is
jellophones.
there's the grill of a late 60s Ford, mid-60s Ford sedan. There's a lot of stuff on. There's a T-shirt cannon that's being used to play instruments. So,
well, Paul, you're no stranger to creating your own instruments. I mean, your own quadricord. Now, these make for unique performance opportunities. It's not like someone in Hartford, Connecticut, then can suddenly come and perform this. They need some very specific instruments.
Yes,
for this.
These are and Dennis's instruments are in some ways like mine, are often created for a theatrical context or a music theater context. So although all of his pieces are grounded in a musical motivation, he has found a way to create a wonderful theatrical context to have these inventions and the music performed. The 24 Preludes and Fugues actually is an interesting, he's taking his, rather than Bach's 24 Preludes and Fugues, which is a prelude and a fugue in each of the 12 chromatic keys, Dennis is dividing the octave from 1 to 24 subdivisions over the course of the whole two-hour suite. We're just doing preludes and fugues 1 through 6. So the first one is basically just octaves. The second one is tritones. The third is a diminished scale. The fourth is an augmented scale.
Improvisation involved in that?
No, it's all written out.
Mm-hmm. Nice. So the Paul Drescher Ensemble, electroacoustic band with Ned Rothenberg and the Living Earth Show, Dennis Anand's Preludes and Fugues, will be performed Friday and Saturday at Z Space. For information, go to zspace.org, or for more on the always omnipresent and omnicreative Drescher Ensemble, go to drescherensemble.org. Ned, we're going to go out with another track of yours. Tell us a little bit about Fantasior.
Fantasior is off of a record called Inner Diaspora, which actually features some of the same musicians that were playing when I walked in here. The previous show, which I guess was a Jewish show, and this is off the Jewish series. Mark Feldman, violin, and Eric Friedlander on cello, who are two of the three people in John Zorn's Masada String Trio, together with a tabla player who I work with, Samir Chatterjee, and Jerome Harris on bass. And it has actually some of the same modal genesis that the piece we're going to do, Beyond Sea. And I have to be honest, while much of the beginning and end of my piece is using the notes of the C scale, for those who know some theory, it's not actually, the tonic is not actually C. And this is similar in that it's something in the what we call the Phrygian mode.
Nice. Ned Rothenberg, Paul Drescher, thanks for coming in today. Have some wonderful performances. Hope to catch one of them myself.
Thanks, thank you.
music of Ned Rothenberg, collaborating with Paul Drescher and the Paul Drescher Ensemble concerts on Friday and Saturday. zspace.org for more information about that.
Another long, exhausting day, another $1,000, a matinee, a Pinter play, perhaps a piece of Mahler's. I'll drink to that. And one for Mahler.
A matinee, perhaps, of this Pinter play, The Birthday Party at ACT. And actually, some Mahler is coming up with the Bay Area Rainbow Symphony in March. So thank you, Elaine Stritch, for those cultural recommendations. That from Stephen Sondheim's Company and the classic tune, The Ladies Who Lunch. I'm joined in studio now by our regular commentator, Peter Robinson, with one of the brilliant cast members of Pinter's The Birthday Party at ACT. Scott Wentworth, who plays Goldberg, last appeared at ACT as Lord Burley and Mary Stuart. He starred on Broadway in Lost in Yonkers, Anna Karenina, Getting Married, and Welcome to the Club, for which he was nominated for a Tony Award. A 24-year veteran of Canada's Stratford Festival, he has played such iconic roles as Iago in Othello, the title role in Macbeth, Claudius in Hamlet, the Earl of Gloucester in King Lear, the title role in Henry IV, Part I, and on the lighter side, but no less virtuosic, performances as Sky Masterson in Guys and Dolls, Tevye and Fiddler on the Roof, as well as Shylock and the Merchant of Venice, among others. Next season, he will play James Tyrone in Long Day's Journey Into Night opposite Shauna McKenna. Scott, welcome to Open Air and taking some time out from ACT.
Oh, thank you.
And, of course, welcome to you, Peter.
Yeah, good to be here, David.
Well, congratulations on such a virtuosic performance of Goldberg in this play. Pretty amazing.
Thanks very much. I appreciate that.
Directed by Carrie Perloff herself in a swan song appearance as director. Now, Scott, when did you first encounter Pinter's work?
Well, one is always aware of Pinter's work in the theater, but strangely, I suppose it's my age. When I got to theater school in the early 1970s, Pinter was kind of on the way out of the popular zeitgeist. A lot of his major work had already been written. So I never encountered Pinter professionally, and I've known Carrie for years, and we were working on an Ibsen play up at Stratford a couple of years ago, John Gabriel Borkman, and she was talking about Pinter, and I was like, look, you've worked with Pinter, you love Pinter, this is your guy, if you ever do one, let me know, I'd love to do it, because, you know, he's such a genius and such a great writer, but I've never had the opportunity to explore it. And the day after the U.S. presidential election, she called me up. She said, we have to do The Birthday Party. I'm doing it for my swan song. do you want to be involved in it? And I said, absolutely. And so that's how I ended up marooned over Christmas here in San Francisco.
Well, not a bad place to
not
be.
Not a bad place to be. Okay,
this is early Pinter from 1957, the year of his first published works. And what I didn't realize is that it's based on his own experience. He is apparently playing Tops, the horse's head, in a production of Dugard Peach's A Horse, A Horse on tour, and he spent some sort of a surreal night in a rundown boarding house with a ditzy landlady and a former piano-playing lodger who never seemed to leave. Well, there's the basis.
Yeah, apparently Pinter's plays, as mysterious as they can seem, all had their germination in an actual event, an overheard conversation or a snippet of a conversation, an image that he glanced through a window. So it's very interesting that these seemingly nightmarish kind of plays are all rooted in an actual event.
Well, you say that nightmarish. This and other plays by Pinter have been called claustrophobic. This one's called one of his comedies of menace. Now, is that something that helps you in your interpretation, or does it...
Well, it's good to remember that it does function like a comedy, that, you know, I think part of the challenge of encountering Pinter now, you know, after his death, after the Nobel Prize, reevaluating him, as it were, for the 21st century. You know, he's become a noun. Something is Pinteresque or it isn't. Mm. And I think it's very helpful to go back to the beginning and go, no, this is also a very funny writer. This is someone who began his career in the theater as an actor, who understood about engaging audiences' attention and sympathy and interest. And so it kind of helped us to break through the facade of Pinter as great writer to get down to the level of humanity that underscores all of his work.
I also think there's something really down to earth. It's one of the few plays I can think which begins with "Enter a deck chair attendant."
Yes, and so indeed.
And then you're in a simple, I'm going to call them bed and breakfast rather than a boarding house. So the audience is put into a kind of normal, down-to-earth setting, and then you've spoken about it, and David spoke about the theatre of menace, because as the play gradually moves up a notch, the fear factor begins to take over.
Indeed.
And I think one of the great things about your presentation was that question about reality. People live in different realities, and the stories that Goldberg begins to tell about himself and about his evolution, it really takes you through a whole series of transitions.
Yes. One of the great maxims that Pinter always talked about when he talked about his work was that of the inconsistent past, that there is no accurate past, that we reinvent it all the time in the present for the purposes of the present. And Goldberg certainly, as a fabricator of his own mythology, is
he's a very unreliable narrator.
He's a very unreliable narrator, and then I think that causes the audience to question all the information they're getting. So as you say, there is a kind of snowballing or avalanching of menace and suspicion as the play goes on, and you think, I thought they were talking about one thing, but maybe they're not. And then the play, to me, begins to really work like a dream, where the reality is associative rather than linear. Things can morph into something. Things can be the opposite of what they are. Characters can be the opposite of what they are. And it's not a play that if you apply the rules of logic to it, always necessarily pays back. You have to kind of approach it.
And I think this comes out when they start talking about the Albigensian heresy, about Oliver Plunkett. I mean, yes. Stuff which are just pulled out of zero.
Yes, they're seeming non sequiturs.
Yeah, and
the seeming ambiguity of your character itself on your first entrance, it's kind of intimidating. You're extremely polished looking, where we as an audience don't know whether you're a traveling salesman or a hitman.
Right.
And how do you play that ambiguity?
Well, you
have you already made up your mind as to...
Well, you can't really play the ambiguity, can you? You know, because that's something that an audience kind of takes on itself, because they don't have all the information, and so you become ambiguous because you don't actually put a sign around your neck saying, I'm a good guy, I'm a bad guy, I'm a mafioso, I'm a politician, I'm a rabbi, or whatever it is. You know, Goldberg seems to be a representative of the established order, and that order can be a government, it can be a religion, it can be any kind of organization, as McCann keeps talking about his partner, McCann. It can be the mafia, it can be a government, insurance, it can be anything.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And Stanley, the
deck chair attendants.
Yes. The boarder in the deck chair attendants house is, you know, has in some way run away from the organization and is hiding, living in this temporary bedsit that he's now made his kind of permanent home and family. It's incredibly dysfunctional. These two men come to bring him back into the fold, and that's really the story of the play. But because that's kind of a mythic tale, it also allows the audience to go, whoa, this seems alarmingly like the life I'm living at the moment.
And I want to put a pitch in for Pinter's authenticity, because although there's a fantasy world, they stick very much to British slang in the play. It's quite useful to read the theatre notes. And, you know, there were places I recognised. Lyne's Corner House would be one where I used to have afternoon tea. But there are other words, round the bend, which I think nowadays has moved into everyday jargon. But Boots Library, you know, you think about Boots the chemist, but Boots also had a library section.
That's right.
So I think Pinter has this connection with the everyday world, even though we're existing in the world of theatre and the world of fantasy.
That's right. You know, and one of the questions that I think any production company, any director has to grapple with when producing Pinter now is, you know, do you set it in the world, or do you say, oh, it's taking place now? And I think wisely Carey chose to keep it in the, you know, late 50s, early 60s, and really honor the local habitation that Pinter is set up, so that from that, the mythological story, the psychological story, the timeless story, is actually more available than if you set it in 2018, and
right.
And then you sort of went, well, why didn't they call him on a cell phone, or why didn't they you know, how come they didn't use their GPS to get out of there?
And at the end of the day, it is a tragic comedy. I think one wants to use both those elements, and I think you brought that really to life. I particularly liked your capturing of the East End Cockney Jewish accent, and I don't know how you managed to capture that so effectively.
Well, thank you. I listen to a lot of people talking. I listen to Pinter talking, and even though his speech, because, you know, he was initially an actor, it was polished up. That's the neighborhood he grew up in. And there's a sense that in the play that Pinter's, that as the playwright, he kind of appears both as Stanley, the disenfranchised artist and the young man writing the play, and as Goldberg, as a potential future self, and a representative of the past that he came out of in the Jewish neighborhoods of East London, and so that was very important. Again, I think. You know, it's very important to remember that Pinter was a Jewish artist. That you know, we, especially in North America, we tend to think of him as quintessentially British,
right?
And in many ways, you know, he is.
Well, he has references to cricket, which
it was his obsession. Apparently, was cricket, and you know, in No Man's Land, all of the characters are named after famous cricket players. So I mean, he obviously loved.
He speaks
the sport.
About the Ashes, which is a cricket series, and whether the pitch was wet in Melbourne.
That's right. That's the big controversy. You know, yes. You know, I'm Canadian, so I played a little bit of cricket in my youth, and it will drive you mad, so I completely understand Pinter.
Right.
It's Scott Wentworth starring as Goldberg in the ACT production of Harold Pinter's The Birthday Party. Talking also with Peter Robinson, our regular contributor here to KLW's Open Air. I'm David Latulip, your host. Peter will be talking about the Mostly British Film Festival shortly. We'll also hear from the group Taraf Akatsva before the hour is out. Scott, what fun to be working with Judith Ivey. Amazing performance as Meg. Director Carey Perloff says that in her last year, this swan song year, she could play her, if you'll pardon the expression, her trump card, and get someone like Judith to play Meg. What's it been like working with her?
Judy is a beautiful person and a beautiful actress. Carey has assembled... You know, she jokes about this. You know, it's like, it's my last play, you have to come. She's been trying to get Judith here for years. they'd worked together back in New York. And you know, Marco Baricelli, to get him to come back after being a company member here for so many years was very important to Carey, and I think for the audience's enjoyment of the play. Again, you know, it's an incredible piece of writing in that it's an amazing ensemble play. You know, the shifting allegiances and the shifting dynamics. You know, you begin the play and you think, oh, this is going to be a play about this woman, and then Stanley enters, you think, oh no, this is going to be a play about this guy, and then Goldberg enters, oh, this is going to be a play about this guy, Petey, it's going to be a play about this guy, McCann at the top of Act Two, oh, it must be a play about him. So we're constantly shifting our focus, and it makes it great to be a part of this, because it really is an ensemble piece, and you know, Judy and has to carry the ball for the next group of people to come on. I have to pass the ball to the next. You know, it's it makes the playing of it really fun.
So tell us how Cary Perloff comes into the equation then as director. I mean, you're all very seasoned actors. You know of Pinter. You know how they should be presented. What did Cary bring to the picture?
What Cary brings to the equation in this production and all the times I've worked with her is an incredibly inquisitive mind. She trained before entering the theater, which was our good fortune. She trained as an archaeologist, which was a loss to the archaeological profession. She likes to just dig things up. She's really, really curious, and because she's super smart, her curiosity is always in the direction of more information about the play, about the characters, about the life of why we're doing the play now. And in this particular case, the last time she directed the play, Mr. Pinter was in the room with her, so there was a bit of living library about it, of, you know, what did Harold say about this part of the play? And then that would lead to an interesting story. Or what about the play seems different to you now based on when you did it before? You know, there was a sense of a real tradition being passed, which is rare in the
theater.
A
sense of memory, having worked with Pinter.
Yes.
But also, she did produce a couple of plays in her Oxford days up at Edinburgh at the Fringe Festival. And I think, again, you're dealing with small stages there, intimate conversations, where the set is part of the action, but the real conversation is focused on the actors speaking to each other.
Yes, yes. You know, and that's a challenge. I mean, the Geary is a huge space play Pinter in.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and that's why, you know, we were very dependent on our designers and on our coaches in making sure that we were both true to the intimacy and reality of the writing, but also true to the architectural demands of that theater. And I found it really interesting because you know, Pinter is a total theater artist, you know, a playwright, obviously, but he also enjoyed screenwriting. He began as an actor. I saw a really funny interview with Michael Caine when he was doing the remake of the film of Sleuth, which was Pinter's last screenplay. He rewrote the Schaeffer play quite brilliantly. And Michael Caine kept referring to Harold Pinter as David. Mm-hmm. And for a moment you think, oh, you've lost your mind, Michael, right. Sir Michael. But no, he said, I'm sorry, I mean Harold. He said, I knew him when he was an actor, and his name was David Barron.
Right.
We were good chums back in the old days. So I just think of him as David. And I thought, how funny. It's Harold Pinter. Yeah. Surely you know his real name. And so he was a chum. He was a drinking buddy. We called him David.
Yeah.
It was brilliant.
Scott Wentworth is Goldberg in the ACT production of Harold Pinter's amazing play from 1950. The Birthday Party, starring with Judith Ivey as Meg, Julie Adamo as Lulu, Furtis Bamji as Stanley, Marco Baricelli as McCann, local treasure Dan Hyatt as Petey. Information at act-sf.org. It's at the Geary through February 4th. I should also mention that in connection with The Birthday Party, ACT has several remaining interact events, many of which are presented free of charge, and that includes this coming Tuesday at 7 p.m. Before the show, raise a glass of wine for a wine tasting event from Wente Vineyards. And then, speaking of matinees of Pinter plays, on Saturday, February 3rd at 12:45, before the performance, get hands-on with the artists who make it happen for an interactive theater workshop. Scott Wentworth, I wish you a continued fantastic run. Such a pleasure to have and an honor to have you here in studio.
Thanks for having me. I had a great time.
Of course.
Fast at hands command.
Rule Britannia, indeed, for our next segment, continuing along a British front with Peter Robinson giving us a preview of the Mostly British Film Festival in Marin. Hey, Peter.
Hi, David. Back to be here again. And just before we go into the British Film Festival, I'm going to say a word about Paddington 2. And I should explain, I've not gone soft in the head. This initially is seen as a children's movie, but in fact I think it has a lot to say for today about our current times. And the story about Paddington is essentially a story about a bear, that's a real animated bear, who turns up living with a British family. The head of that family is played by Hugh Bonneville, and it's a delightful story about, I'm going to say, being polite. So Paddington will steal your heart. It's also an immigrant story because the bear represents somebody arriving in London. We've just heard Rule Britannia. It's a very British film. It kicks off at Paddington Station in Notting Hill. And there are a lot of shots which certainly brought memories back to me of Portobello Road, which is a great place for antiquarian books, for antiques, for all types of traders. So if you're going to dismiss Paddington 2 because you think it's a children's film, think again. It's well worth going to, well worth seeing. It has a great cast, certainly an unusual cast in the sense that Hugh Grant plays a villain. Instead of being the depreciating English guy, he's now the criminal in the story. And it's also a film which is very, very funny. Highly recommended. Paddington 2, well worth going to see. Now, the other British connection today, I know we were talking about Harold Pinter early on, is the mainly British Film Festival. And this is an opportunity at the Vogue Theatre where you can see 22 films in the week. They are Irish films, there are Scottish films, there are Australian films. And people who remember Downton Abbey may be pleased to hear that Joan Froggatt, who appeared as the maid to Lady Mary Corley, is going to be on stage talking about different parts of her own film career on Friday, February the 16th. There are three flashbacks to the what they called the British New Wave, British from the 60s, and I'm going to be introducing a movie with Michael Caine. It's called Alfie. It has that great soundtrack by Shirley Bassey, What's It All About, Alfie. And it's the story of really a Cockney Casanova, a mischievous, funny, lovable anti-hero who plays the role of the lodger in the, again, a rooming world, a bed and breakfast, really, in London. So if you enjoy Michael Caine, this is the early Michael Caine, great movie to see, and it's screening at 6:45 at the Vogue Theatre. Now, that mainly British film festival, which emphasises the British New Wave, is also featuring Julie Christie in a move called Darling, and it finishes with A Taste of Honey. So you've got historic British films, and then you've got contemporary. And I'm going to highlight a couple of the Australian movies which play on February the 20th. The first is called The Death and Life of Otto Bloom. They're actually, in Australian terms, called this a bockumentary, M-O-C-K, a mockumentary, because it kind of sends up the documentary side. But there are also two thrillers also coming out of Australia. One is called Sweet Country. It's set in 1929, and it's about a murder where the wrong man is set up and chased by the posse. So it's a great piece of cinematography as we see the outback wide and large. And also Goldstone, another Australian detective story. The Scottish evening has that great classic Whiskey Galore. So again, we're set in Scotland. And I always smile because sometimes people ask in the Mostly British Film Festival if the Scottish documentaries can have subtitles. Well, that seemed okay until it came to some of the adjectives the Scots use, often beginning with F. And you suddenly see this in print with two asterisks next to it. And you can't tell what you're reading because it may not make total sense to you, but you may be shocked. And if you're shocked, you're enjoying what the film is really about. So don't miss Whiskey Galore and then another Scottish movie, The Hippopotamus. So the festival opening night at 7:30. It's a film about R.D. Lang called Mad to be Normal. People who may remember R.D. Lang was both a poet and a psychologist. So you've got a full range of very interesting movies, 22 altogether in 1 week. It's happening at the Vogue Theatre, and it begins at the beginning of February, on February the 15th, and it closes with the great classic film Journey's End, which incidentally is introduced by Tony Broadbent, a British novelist. So enjoy everything from Ireland, from Scotland, from Australia, from the UK at the Mostly British Film Festival.
More information at mostlybritish.org. Thanks so much, Peter.
Thank you.
That's the extremely catchy, folk-inspired sound of Tarafta Akatsa, which is currently on its second U.S. tour through February 11th to various California venues. Prominently featured in that track was Lulu De La Rue, who joins me by phone to tell us about the group and tour. Lulu, welcome to Open Air.
Hello.
Hi, are you there?
Yes, I'm here.
Great. Well, so tell us about how this group got started and was subsequently named.
Well, we started about 4 years ago in Budapest, Hungary. And it was all traveling street musicians. I was one myself with my friend Johannes Olsen from Sweden. And we met in Budapest, and we decided to start something. And we had different musicians playing with us at the time, and then it evolved, and now we have a whole new instrumentation and new members, and now the current group has six people, and on this tour we're only four people, but the rest had to stay.
I was going to ask, who made it over for this tour?
Johannes, the accordion player, and Abel, the bass player, and Zach, who's American, was already in America, so we were lucky about that.
So there's a flexible instrumentation for these tunes, I guess?
It can be, yeah, but we prefer to always keep the same instrumentation, which is with cymbalum, which is a Hungarian-Romanian instrument. Are you familiar with that instrument?
Yeah, sure. Beautiful sound.
Yeah. So that's actually featured on our album. We have that recorded with cymbalum. And now we have a singer, so that's a whole new sound. So, yeah.
So is the group, the tunes you choose, are they a combination of original tunes and known folk tunes?
Yeah, we have a lot of original compositions. The accordion player Johannes, he wrote some folk inspired compositions. You can also speak, Johannes.
Yes, I'm here actually.
Oh, welcome, Johannes. Hello.
We have multiple phones here, so I can hear everything what's going on.
Excellent. Accordionist Johannes Olsen joining Lulu here.
Yes. I'm from Sweden, and this is our second tour in the States with Lulu and Isaac. And we have the new our new bass player Abel, which we're really glad to have here, and we're gonna have a guest appearance from Corey Beers today on the
from Los Angeles.
From Los Angeles.
Nice. Well, tell us what countries' sounds have been mined for these concerts.
A lot of the songs we're playing is from Romania and Moldova. And we also play, like, our own like kind of mixture of Bulgarian songs that we put together into, yeah, well, the way that we like it, and also a few Serbian songs, and also a few own compositions, but mostly it's Romanian music.
And will the sets be consistent from locale to locale?
Well, we actually have a lot of Hungarian, where they wanted us to play Hungarian music, so we're also going to be playing Hungarian or Transylvanian folk music, and some shows will be purely Balkan dance events, so they'll be focused towards Balkan music, and so we're just flexible, and we try to cater to their needs.
Well, it sounds great, especially from the from what tracks we've heard from the CD that's recently out. Now, full disclosure, you've got a great publicist in the form of your mom. My friend Isabelle Chapuis, principal flutist of the San Jose Opera. They're about to mount Wagner's Flying Dutchman, although your mom's not playing for that particular production. Information about that at operasj.org. So thank your mom for this as well.
Yes. Very much.
Thanks, Mom.
The tour gets underway tonight for a house concert in Los Altos. They'll be in Berkeley at Ashkenaz on February 2nd and the Red Poppy House in San Francisco on the 8th, with lots of stops along the way, including Monterey, Half Moon Bay, Davis, and winding up in L.A. on the 11th at the Museum of Jurassic Technology. Now, that's a museum I've got to check out for sure.
Oh, yeah, it's a special place.
Very great venue.
Well, we're going to go out with a track called, and help me out with my pronunciation here, Rustum Portata in Verita de Peso. Help me out. What's
in
that?
Vertita
track six?
Is the third track, or third song. So, Rustum Portata in Verita, and the last one?
In verita de pesomes hora moldovenesca.
Yeah. Hora moldovenesca.
And that has
the last one.
That has a unique meter. That's a fascinating track that we're going to go out on.
Okay.
It's music of Taraf da Akatsa. More information on their Facebook page, or easier yet, follow the link at our open air page at klw.org. Lulo Johannes, I wish you a great tour, and maybe come by for a studio visit sometime.
All right. Next time.
All right. Cheers.
Thank you.
Music of Taraf da Akatsa on tour through various venues here in California. Check out the link at our page, klw.org. Look for Open Air. I'm David LaTulipe. You've been listening to Open Air. Just time for a brief musical birthday tribute to one of the truly great composers of our time, Antonio Carlos Jobim's birthday today. Brazilian composer, pianist, songwriter, arranger, singer. 65 album Gets Gilberto was the first jazz album to win the Grammy Award for Album of the Year, also won Best Jazz Instrumental Album, left a large number of songs that are now included in jazz and pop standard repertoires, including this, Corcovado. Oh, I'm sorry, Girl from Ipanema.
porque estou tão sozinho. Ah, porque tudo é tão triste. Ah, beleza que existe. A beleza que não é só minha, que também passa sozinha. Ah, se ela soubesse que quando ela passa, o mundo sorrindo se enche de graça e fica mais lindo por causa do amor.
Tall and thin and young and lovely, the girl from Ipanema goes walking, and when she passes, each one she passes goes, she walks, she's like a samba that swings so cool and sways so gently that when she passes, each one she passes goes, ah. Oh, but you watch her so sadly. She walks to the sea, she looks straight ahead, not at he. Tall and thin and young and lovely, the girl from Ipanema goes walking, and when she passes, he smiles, but she doesn't see.
Happy birthday to the late, great Antonio Jobim, born this day in 1927, left us in 1994, but left such a vast library of incredible, incredible tunes. My thanks to Niels Swinkels for producing Open Air. Our shows are archived at kalw.org. If you've got a show suggestion for a segment, by all means, send me an email to david@kalw.org. Thanks for listening. ¶¶